It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A bill heading to the governor's desk would ban cell phones in the classroom in public schools during instructional time statewide. That bill passed the Senate 29-4 on Tuesday after passing the Assembly earlier this year. There was bipartisan support in the Senate, though some Democrats have pushed back, saying it overrides local control of school districts. The bill's sponsor, Representative Joel Kitchens, has said that the bill is a unified approach to enforcing existing cell phone policies in schools around the state. WPR reporter Rich Kramer is following the story. Rich, welcome back.
Good to be back.
All right, this bill headed to the governor. If he signs off on it, Rich, what exactly would change?
So it would require that public school boards across the state create policies prohibiting students from using cell phones, tablets, laptops, those sorts of devices during instructional time, that is to say, during class. There are exceptions built into this bill. Students would be allowed to use their phones for emergencies if there were threats. They can use them for medical reasons and if it's part of a lesson plan from an instructor.
The Senate passed the bill, as I mentioned, Tuesday. There has been some pushback from Democrats, particularly in the Assembly and from school district administrators, a few of them. What concerns have you heard raised about this?
So among Democrats, we heard this during the previous debate in the Assembly, and also we heard it this week on the Senate floor. Democrats in general claim that this is a violation of the principle of local control, which they say Republicans espouse. They say that local school boards should be trusted to make these sorts of decisions. They also mention that a lot of districts already have some sort of policy in place, and they know what's best for their students. There have also been arguments from Democrats that students should be able to call their parents. They should be able to access their phone in the event of, like, a lockdown or a mass shooting. We have heard from school superintendents, specifically Nicolet Union High School District Superintendent, that this bill is too broad. It's too vague. They need more clarity. For example, they say that they've got a one-to-one wireless learning kind of a platform where students use these devices as part of the curriculum, and they might have to write an exception into that if this were to pass.
The bill is going to Governor Evers' desk. He has some experience in the educational field himself. Has he given any indication, Rich, of whether he's planning to sign off on this?
He's keeping the cards pretty close to the vest right now. I did reach out to Governor Evers' spokesperson and asked point blank, you know, when the Senate passed this bill, whether he would sign it or veto. I haven't heard back yet. But as you mentioned, he was the State Department of Public Instruction superintendent for a long time. And in general, as governor, and even then, he hasn't been a fan of any legislation that he feels is telling schools how to run their operations. That said, cell phone bans have been a bipartisan thing in a lot of other states. Mm-hmm. They've passed in states like New York and Illinois. A lot of states have these. So at this point, I haven't really seen any indication of what Evers will do.
Rich, thanks for bringing us up to date.
You got it. Thank you.
That's Rich Kramer, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. You can follow his reporting and watch for updates on this issue at WPR.org. Now, what do bans like these mean for students? Dr. Megan Moreno is professor of pediatrics at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and co-medical director of the Center of Excellence on Social Media and Youth Mental Health with the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Moreno, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
As Rich just mentioned, Wisconsin is not the first state to consider these cell phone bans in schools. It's still a fairly new issue. What have we seen around the country? What have we learned so far from efforts to say, hey, no cell phones and other tech while teaching time is going on?
Well, one thing that we do know is that a lot of the consideration of this issue is driven by some studies that have shown that without any regulation, without any rules, that a lot of youth are using their phones in the classroom. There was one study that found that 97% of adolescents use their phone during school hours. And in that study, the most common thing they used it for was social media, YouTube, and video games. So clearly there is an issue here that we're all working really hard to try to understand and address.
And based on a sample size of one, me, I know having that phone out can be a distraction. It can interrupt my focus when I'm trying to concentrate. If I just want to take a quick peek at something, have we studied what this means for how students learn in school if that phone is there in their pocket during their math lesson, say?
That's such a great question. The studies here have been mixed. And what the studies have found is that the way the technology is used really impacts what the outcome is. And that's probably not surprising. We know that many youth are using school-issued devices or laptops. And if they're using them as part of a classroom assignment, it can really make the learning even better. But if they're using them to goof off or entertain themselves between assignments or multitask, that's where we see that learning is impacted in a negative way.
I've seen some anecdotal reporting anyway. I don't think it's intensive studies, but some districts saying, hey, we've had a ban of some sort in place. The phones stay in the pockets or in a bucket or whatever in school, and we're seeing improvements in learning. Do we have enough out there to say, yes, having the phones not available to the kids is boosting learning, however we measure that?
We don't know that yet. And I think some of that is because many of these new guidelines and rules are rolling out very fast and without a lot of thought to how are we going to define what success is and how are we going to measure success. So we have a lot of school districts that are doing this in a brand new way, but not really tracking what the outcomes are. So I'm hoping that as we see more schools trying these new policies, that they'll factor in feedback from parents, feedback from teachers, feedback from youth, so we can really understand what these policies are doing.
There's been a lot of push over the last 20 years, weirdly, to get more screens in school, right? We want to use the latest technology for education. Flipping things around, Dr. Moreno, from what we don't want kids to do with technology in the school, do we know about positive, effective uses of technology? Maybe it's that school-issued device as part of a lesson plan.
Definitely. I think that there are studies and there are also probably teachers can share great examples of ways that technology can really boost learning instead of reading about a famous speech, to be able to watch a video or to hear it. To be able to use computers for writing a school paper. There's just so many ways that technology can augment learning and also put learning in more of a real life experience that youth are going to have after school.
Part of your work is trying to look at issues like this, not just in schools, but social media in general, through the eyes of teens and adolescents and how they view it. What do you know? What kind of things have you heard about what kids themselves think about cell phone access in their schools?
Yes, this has been somewhat surprising to me. I think what I have heard from many youth is that they want the rules to be very clear so they understand when phones are appropriate, when they're not. They want to make sure their parents know the rules, because what we're starting to see in some studies is that the biggest violators of contacting kids during the school day is parents. So they want to make sure their parents know so that they're not going to get in trouble with their parents if their parent is trying to reach them. And they want the rules to be respectful and consistent. So if the person next to them is using their phone in class and doesn't get in trouble, but then they do that and they get in trouble, that feels to them like this isn't a rule that's consistent. So I think a boon of having some of the rules that are really clear and enforced consistently is that kids can relax and say, okay, this is what we're all going to do.
We saw an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, someone with the American Enterprise Institute, making the case for cell phone bans in schools, the benefit, they say, improved mental health for kids. Do you see any kind of mental health benefit potentially, apart from that clarity you were just talking about, to not having those cell phones in the classroom?
We have heard from youth when we've done focus groups on this topic that not having to keep up with social interactions using the phone can be a relief during the school day, and there's less worrying about cyberbullying during the school day. So cyberbullying during the school day with phones can include things like taking an embarrassing picture or an embarrassing video, and kids really worry about that. And those types of bans that don't allow access during the classroom can really put some of those worries away for kids.
We're waiting to see if the governor is going to sign this law. Of course, with or without the law, school districts are wrestling with these issues all over the state and all over the world, really. If a school district administrator or school board member came to you and said, hey, we're trying to update our policy, what kind of things would be on your checklist? What kind of questions would you be telling them to consider in that decision?
That's a great question. I think that it really gets down to what the goal is of these policies. And to me, I think the goal is to have a safe, healthy environment focused on learning. So the key words there are safe. The environment needs to be safe. Parents need to feel like their kids are safe and that they can access their phones in the case of a medical or another type of emergency. It needs to be a healthy environment where kids feel respected. They feel like the rules are enforced the same for everyone, and they can feel like they can get to their phone if they really need to reach their parents or have a medical emergency. And then an environment focused on learning, making sure teachers feel well supported and that they don't need to switch their focus to constantly enforcing a new rule that they that could be really challenging for them if there is a lot of folks having difficulty adjusting to that rule.
Dr. Moreno, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Megan Moreno, professor of pediatrics at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health and co-medical director of the Center of Excellence on Social Media and Youth Mental Health with the American Academy of Pediatrics. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Rich Kramer talking about a cell phone ban in classrooms, with some exceptions, as we heard, passed the legislature, waiting for action from Governor Evers. Want to hear from you. What do you think of this idea? Should cell phones be banned or limited for students in the classroom? What's your personal experience as a student, a parent, a teacher? Love to hear from you. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, Wisconsin has one active nuclear power plant. Another could be put back online in coming years. Hear how the local community views plans for the Kewanee Power Station, southeast of Green Bay.
It's kind of gut-wrenching because I don't think the plant should have been shut down, but it was big business and they didn't care about the local community.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has one active nuclear power plant, but another could be back online in coming years. A Utah-based nuclear power company announced earlier this year that it's seeking approval from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to bring a plant back online in Kewaunee County. The former Kewaunee Power Station, southeast of Green Bay, shut down in 2013. That leaves the Point Beach nuclear plant as the only one operating in the state. The two are about 5 miles apart on the Lake Michigan shoreline. We're checking in on plans for the project in Kewaunee County and how it fits into Wisconsin's nuclear energy production. David Hartke is board chairman for the town of Carlton, which is home to the Kewaunee Power Station. He talked to Kate Archer Kent last week.
Can you give us a little history of the Kewaunee Power Station and what happened when it shut down in 2013?
Well, the Kewaunee Power Station was being built when I was a senior in high school. And it's kind of gut-wrenching because I don't think the plant should have been shut down, but it was big business and they didn't care about the local community. And I think they could have left it up and running and could have added another unit if that's what they wanted to do. It was set up for that. So,
how did it affect the community?
We used to pretty much run the town budget off our utility tax. So we had to raise taxes to equal to about $450,000.
What has happened with the property in the 12 years since it was shut down?
Energy Solutions purchased the property, and they are in the process of decommissioning it. And it's going to take them about, I think they said, 2030 to complete the job. So it's a long process.
Energy Solutions is this Utah-based nuclear power company. Has the town had any communication with it?
Yes, they come to our monthly board meetings, and they are a very good company to work with compared to the old owners. And they keep us informed as how far they are with taking things down, and also they are looking for a partner to possibly rebuild.
What have they said about rebuilding? What would that entail?
Well, it would take till probably about 3 to 4 years to get the permits and the license for it, and possibly up to 8 to 10 years to build.
You have a long history with this town. How open do you think Kewaunee County residents are to nuclear energy being produced on the site again?
I can't speak for the whole county, but the residents of the town of Carlton are in favor of it because we have nuclear waste sitting there, so we can't do anything else with the property. So the best use for it would be to produce more power.
How do you think the energy needs of data centers that we see popping up around Wisconsin, how might that factor into what's happening here with the prospects of this new power plant?
Well, there was a company that wanted to build a data center, and the people in the town were dead set against it because they require a lot of power and they'd like to be close to the plant. But so what's going to happen with that, I don't know. But the people in the town are all for the plant, but they are not for data centers and solar.
What kind of authority does the town of Carlton and Kewaunee County, for that matter, have in helping to shape what happens to the site and the surrounding area? Do you feel like you have a voice?
I feel like we have a voice. I don't know if anybody's listening to us, but basically when it comes to power plants, if they want to put it there, they're going to put it there anyway, but I'd prefer to work with them and have a good relationship with them, and I do believe they feel the same.
You know, towns can't always pick and choose what kind of developers come in, but if you could wave that magic wand, what do you think the people of Carlton would want to have happen to the site and the surrounding area?
The people in Carlton are pretty much an agricultural-based community, and they would like it to stay that way with the exception of the nuclear plant. We had a public meeting on it, and the people pretty much, with the exception of one person, there was 100 people in attendance, and one person questioned the safety of it, but, you know, nobody else seems to be bothered by it.
What is the population of Carlton?
1,000 people.
1,000 people. So I would imagine then farmland would be in production around the plant. Is there active farming going on?
Oh, yes. The previous owners and Energy Solutions have been renting out the 900 some acres that they own. And they've been renting out to local farmers. But the town itself is agricultural based, and with a data center that wanted to come in here, they wanted at least 1,200 acres. And that to me is too much. It's going to affect the livelihood of a lot of people in the town.
So in Carlton, would you be a workforce ready town for nuclear if a plant would ultimately open up? Like, what might your town do to prepare?
The actual town Probably not a lot. There used to be a trailer park in there for some of the workers when they built the old plant. That has since been taken down and converted over into farmland again. Most of the people, you know, Manitowoc and Two Rivers aren't that far away, and Kewaunee, of course. But a lot of the people that worked at the plant did not live in the town of Carlton other than some construction workers and guards.
But your tax base, you see, could change significantly if this plant goes through.
Yes. And like I said, I think that's the best use for the land right now. And the people in Carlton are used to nuclear. They aren't afraid of it. I remember when the old plant first started up and they had a outstanding young farmer competition in Michigan. And they offered to take them to Point Beach plant to give them a tour.
Point Beach is the only active nuclear power plant now in the state. It's along Lake Michigan. Is that right? Manitowoc County?
Yes. But they could not get one person to take that tour because back then, back in the 1980s, they were afraid of nuclear power. You know, So the people in Carlton are used to it and they're in favor of it. But they aren't in favor of them, the companies gobbling up thousands of acres of land.
For the data centers.
A data center and as well as the nuclear plant also. They own 960 acres before, and they were looking for another 1,200 acres. And they won't explain why.
David, thank you for this update. Appreciate you joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That is David Hartke, board chairman for the town of Carlton. He was with us to share how his community is grappling with plans to bring back nuclear energy to the Kewaunee Power Station. Now we turn to the broader landscape of nuclear energy in Wisconsin, with the Point Beach Nuclear Plant near Two Rivers receiving a license renewal for 20 more years of operation. Ben Lindley is an assistant professor of nuclear engineering and engineering physics at UW-Madison. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
How much nuclear energy does Wisconsin produce right now from the Point Beach nuclear plant, our only one that's operating here? What is it like in the nuclear mix?
Yes. So as you say, Wisconsin has one operating nuclear plant right now. I believe it's comprised of two units and comes in at just over one gigawatt electric, which is a sizable chunk of electricity. Historically, Wisconsin's operated a couple of other nuclear plants as well.
And this Point Beach nuclear plant, which is on the shores of Lake Michigan near Two Rivers, it just got its license renewed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for another 20 years. Is that significant? How big of a deal is that?
Oh, I think this is very good news for nuclear in Wisconsin and also for continuing to, you know, keep our electricity supply going strong. I would say it's not surprising. It's pretty common for nuclear plants to seek license extensions. They often have licenses for a particular period of time, and there's been a growing move over the last decade or two to extend those licenses and run to 60 or, by the looks of things, even 80 years for the case of Point Beach. And it's a sort of vote of confidence in the economics of the plant. So given the current economic climate, given the growing demand for electricity, I'd say one of the key things here is it shows that the operators of the plant thought it was economically viable to keep running that unit and do the work required to extend its license.
In this climate, then, why do you think there is an appetite now to reopen a nuclear plant like the one in Kewaunee County?
Well, we're seeing changes in the energy landscape over the last few years. The Ukraine crisis being one key example that changed the way the oil and gas markets worked. We're also been seeing strong economic growth in the United States, which has increased demand for electricity. And so between these two things, there's been sufficient increases in electricity prices to drive and these sufficient increases in demand to drive both keeping existing units open, but then more, you know, then also very importantly to motivate investment in new power generation assets. And a big one, I mean, this is everyone can see on the news, is demand from AI. So demand for these big data centers, which have coming onto the grid, consuming significant amounts of electricity, and that's happened quite rapidly. So that's one piece of the overall picture that's quite important.
So if the Kewaunee Power Station would go back online producing nuclear energy as planned, what impact might that have on energy production in Wisconsin? How big of a deal would it be?
Well, I think this would be good news in terms of increasing electricity production in Wisconsin, and then a local generation asset with plenty of jobs, both in building a new plant or refurbishing pieces of what they've already got, but most likely building new infrastructure at that site. And then also in terms of the skilled jobs required to operate that plant, this would help ease pressure on electricity demand in Wisconsin, especially at times of peak demand, which can be both summer and winter. So overall, I think it would be good news for the state. I guess it's also a good way of stimulating investment in other things. If we have the additional electricity generating capacity, it can motivate siting of other things that may use that electricity. Of course, there you've got to balance that versus what people, whether people want to host, for example, data centers in their community. But overall, it can be a boon to economic growth.
In terms of that investment, though, I mean, nuclear plants can cost billions of dollars to build and come online. What might it cost to make a decommissioned plant operational again?
Yeah, so that's a good point. I think with Kewaunee, it's to my knowledge, it is best to think of it as mostly like building a new plant on a site where an old plant had been. Hmm. I think Kewaunee's been non-operational for long enough that it would be a case of building new infrastructure there. We've seen in other states where plants that have come offline relatively recently, they sort of refurbish them, try and bring them back. You know, here we're probably a few years out from that. So what about the investment? Well, what we see with nuclear is, yeah, these can be billions of dollars of investment. Some of this depends on the size of a plant. So if we can imagine a world where you build, it could be 2 gigawatt scale power plants, for example, and that, 2 gigawatt electric. Now that would be an investment that would, could easily run to $10 billion. You could also imagine putting smaller units on the site. So there's this big push at the moment for what's called small modular reactors, which are a few hundred megawatt electric each. So you can imagine building, something more in the range of 0.3 to 1 gigawatt electric there. And then the investment scales accordingly. In any instance where you build more than one unit on the same site, you would tend to stagger it. So you start building the first one and then move on to the second one. The two might be going up in parallel. And yeah, this is a big investment. And as your question alluded to, the capital cost of nuclear is a significant challenge to overcome in getting these things built.
So if you're building this power plant campus, if you will, how far away would it need to be from, say, a data center that really needs its power, to function? How could those two be in close proximity?
They could be, but they don't have to be.
Okay.
So, the electricity grid's a really good way of moving power between generation assets and consumers, right? So, and especially if we look at Kewaunee, it was previously had this quite large power plant there, which means that, and I don't know the specifics of that site, but mm-hmm. I can only assume that they have a pretty good grid interconnector there that takes the power to where demand is located. And that connection could then be used to transport the power from nuclear energy, wherever the nuclear plant, to wherever it needs to go. Now, there's interest from data center operators in co-locating with nuclear plants and then having some sort of behind-the-meter arrangement where they don't go via the grid, but it doesn't have to be that way. You could imagine building a nuclear plant and maybe there's a data center somewhere else in Wisconsin, or maybe it's not even in Wisconsin, and you could still be balancing supply and demand across the electricity grid of the whole Midwest.
Okay, so a much more robust network there to move it. So it sounds as if as well that there have been a lot of advancements in nuclear and how these stations operate and the technology. What about the nuclear waste it would generate? You know, where would it go if the Kewaunee Power Station would reopen?
Yeah, this is one of the sort of unsolved dilemmas in U.S. nuclear power. And what tends to happen right now is that the nuclear waste is stored on site. So initially it's stored in what's called wet storage, where you have it cooling down in these big cooling ponds, so essentially swimming pools with waste fuel in. And then it's put into really robust canisters and then stored in what's called dry storage. So you'd have a robust concrete canister and it'd be stored on a essentially something that's more like a warehouse or something that's on the surface after that. Now, this is not ideal in the long term. It works. It's been done in the nuclear plants for decades, but it's not the most cost-effective solution long term. And there's long been discussions about having a what's called a geological repository for this waste, where you would store a large amount of spent fuel there, and it would stay there indefinitely. The challenge there is agreeing on a site for this waste, and then it's the substantial investment associated with building it.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
You are very welcome. Thank you for hosting me.
Ben Lindley is an assistant professor of nuclear engineering and engineering physics at UW-Madison. He talked to Kate Archer-Kent about nuclear energy in Wisconsin as developers seek to bring back a nuclear plant in Kewaunee County. Earlier, we heard from Town of Carlton Board Chair David Hartke about how the community feels about the potential return of nuclear energy to the area. Coming up, a Wisconsin project gives people in prison a chance to prepare for life after their sentences are over.
All these things that we want people to be when they come home from prison, all of that starts first and foremost by seeing the human being.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. It can be tough to build community in prison, but some people who are incarcerated find community by sharing a meal. Last month on Milwaukee's East Side, a public event called Cell to Table highlighted the creative food sometimes created in prison. It's organized by The Community, a nonprofit that seeks to correct what its leaders say is a false narrative about people with criminal records. The event is a ticketed food experience that shows the meals created on the inside using few tools and few ingredients. Producer Mackenzie Crummy attended the event where formerly incarcerated people showed off their creativity in the kitchen.
The tuna wraps, fantastic. Not the tuna I'm used to in prison.
Food in prison is supposed to be awful.
This is like ahi sushi quality tuna. It's really spicy. It's really delicious.
But what if I told you that it can, at times, be delicious?
I've tasted some of the best stuff I've had in prison. I'm not saying go to prison and taste food. I just, you know, it's, but I've had a lot of really good stuff there. So
that's Brianna Krieger. She is not talking about the food served inside the prison, which she says is actually disgusting, but the meals she and her friends were able to create in their cells together.
I made everything from like jailhouse fried rice, and we would use Pepsi and honey, and it's insane. We'd make fried noodles. We would take ramen noodles and put it in a popcorn bag, put it in the microwave, let it fry up. And I mean, you just get creative.
Brianna and two other formerly incarcerated chefs are preparing a four-course meal for more than 100 paying guests. The chefs are showcasing their creativity and cooking skills they used while incarcerated. Brianna made a dessert for the event called Pop-Tart Pie.
Traditionally, what I would do when I was incarcerated is it would be creamer pudding, Hawaiian punch, Kool-Aid packages, Pop-Tarts, graham crackers, and butter. But tonight, I didn't want people dying of a heart attack eating my food, so we actually made the custard from scratch, and we flavored it really nicely with some real pureed fruit to get that Hawaiian kind of aspect to it.
While in prison, Brianna used ingredients and tools she had on hand, like a small hot pot. She could boil water for noodles, but also get a sous vide-type effect by boiling meat in a tortilla bag. Her best memories, though, sharing meals with others.
Hey, you guys can take away our clothes, you guys can take away our names, you guys can take away, you know, our families, you can rip us of our freedom, but this is one thing that we have, and it's this community that we've been able to kind of forge among the debris and the rubble. So cooking brings everyone together. It always has, and it always will, regardless if you're incarcerated or if you're out in the free world.
Some other menu items for cell to table are the hookup. That's a burrito stuffed with ramen, beef chili, chicken, and crushed Doritos. A side of pineapple mackerel fried rice. And tuna wraps made by Chef Nathan Bailey. He was just released at the beginning of September and already has a job at a local food cart. In prison, he found cooking gave him a creative outlet and something to focus his time.
When I was in the cell, you know, I was thinking about, like, this is what I wanted to do. It just started tumbling for me, you know what I mean? It started working, so I wanted to do this. I wanted to be in the food industry, and so it's clicking. My background, I came from selling drugs, so that was a different level of people pleasing. I just switched my gears around. I just woke up. I'm like, one day, I'm like, I got to do this. Like, I can't keep wasting my life, so.
Nathan says feeding people and bringing them joy with cooking is therapeutic.
It brought them out of that, like, I'm incarcerated. You know what I mean? Like, this is a good meal. And I've always got really good feedback from it. It's cool to get in a place like that because compliments and stuff like that in a situation like that, they don't really come often. It made me feel. It gave me that sense of, like, you know, maybe I should do this.
Mackenzie Crummy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Sarah Hopeful for sound design and for photos from WPR's photojournalist Angela Major. Visit WPR.org. Now we turn to the community, the nonprofit that organized that cell-to-table event. Shannon Ross is a CEO and founder of the nonprofit, which he started while serving a 17-year prison sentence. I started off by asking him, what's the common story around people who are incarcerated and how would you like to see it change?
Generally in society, people navigate the way they understand the criminal legal system and people that have criminal records from a point of danger, fear, indifference, or they deserve it mentality. So what we're trying to do is present opportunities to hear stories that counteract that default way that we approach this issue. And none of this is to blame anybody. This is how we're socialized. We're socialized in this country to view those that have committed a crime or have been in prison from a stance of danger or fear or they deserve it. And so we're just trying to present more nuanced and complete stories so that people can see that those that have a criminal record are not what they've been socialized to believe and are really very much so in many cases a type of person in a demographic that carries so much, not just potential, but humanity and this capacity to do things that regular folks don't because of how close those of us that have been in the system have come to the devil in a sense, right? And so getting to that degree, you can start to find your way back and change who you are in a way that is powerful. That isn't very common for people that haven't been in that position. And so we're just trying to present, at the end of the day, greater stories to show a greater understanding of what it means to engage with a person and be a person that has a criminal record or, you know, have committed a crime.
Well, I'm sure some people listening right now heard you say that and think, well, I do think, you know, people in prison are there because they have done something bad and they deserve to be punished or that they are dangerous and should be, you know, isolated from society. What do you say when you get that, I guess, gut reaction from people as you try to make this case?
Well, there's a couple of ways to respond to it in asking the person, like, why? Why do they think that, right? Because some people might think that because they've been the victim of a crime and they carry that pain and that anger incredibly justifiably. And so that is coloring their determination, their view. Some people simply grew up in a household where that was just the way their parents and their family and their neighborhood saw it. And then some people have never really thought about it, but they just have an instinctual reaction based on media narratives, based on the news, consistently highlighting people who had a record and then got back out and committed another crime. And so like each of those demographics is going to be a different way to approach it. And so at the end of the day, for each one, though, the common denominator for each one is challenging them to really say, what is the ROI on people coming back from prison? Do you want folks to be ready and stable? Do you want people returning who are going to be more dangerous? Which one of those two? And pretty much everyone's going to say, you know, unless their agenda is something different, pretty much everyone's going to say, yeah, I want folks coming back to not commit crimes again. I want folks coming back who are stable and who are not a danger to me and my family. Well, then if we want that, we have to really look at what we're doing when we have someone who goes to the system, what we're the way we're treating them, the way we're providing opportunities, the way that the entire environment and process engages with that person. And that creates a different conversation. It takes the very justified emotions and the very justified fear based on what we've heard out of it, and it focuses more on solutions and that cost benefit. Because the key statistic in all of this is that 90 to 95% of people in prison are coming back to society.
One idea that really struck me in your work, I've had a lot of conversations about re-entry, right? What happens if that person leaves prison, finding housing, jobs, counseling maybe, and so on. You talk about the concept of pre-entry, right? Getting ahead of that, not saying, you know, the day of release, but that, I think, whole period of incarceration working toward that. What changes when we think about pre-entry as opposed to just re-entry?
And that's a perfect part of that mind shift. If we're looking at the element of people coming back to society, it oftentimes sees, and this is an unfortunate element around, I think, how we view things in America. We tend to be more reactive than preventative. And I think that's a pretty safe and fair description of how we have been for a lot of things. You go to other countries, you know, I've visited 5 different countries now in the past 2 years, and you see a different way that in Europe really, really, really does things. And we here think that reentry is the way that we should start investing in folks, because when they are close to release or after they get out, let's start getting them those resources, right? Let's start getting them a job or helping them navigate the things that they need to be stable and stay out and not commit crimes. But the problem is that's akin to educating a child when they're 17. By the time they're 18, what do you think you're going to get if you only started when they're 17? They have 16 years before that of not really having solid guidance and information and opportunities to grow. So when you're inside, if a person has a 10-year sentence, a 20-year sentence, a 5, a 30, whatever number that is, especially if it's a longer sentence, if we're focusing on them by the time they get out or close to the door, you've missed all the years when they were the most in a position to grow, to hear you, to digest the concepts and the encouragement and the possibilities of change and the opportunities as well. And so the one thing that a person has when they're inside that is a wealth that you don't have when you're out is time. They are time wealthy. And when you get out, I've spent 17 years in prison. I had significant time that I used in a variety of ways inside. And when I got out, since the moment I got out, I have never had anything close to that. It has been a whirlwind of being wrapped up in what I call the sea of freedom. So if we can get people inside to understand and give them the pathway to utilize that time wealth while they're inside, they'll be much more prepared by the time they hit that reentry phase, which is the close to release or post-release date.
What does that look like? What kind of DNA change in our prison, in our incarceration system, would it look like to use that time, you know, from the day of entry to be prepared for that day of reentry?
That's the key question, right? I mean, it sounds great, but then what does that actually mean? What does it look like? So on one side of it, it means a really significant cultural shift, which comes from leadership, which comes from the way leadership in any system is viewing the way their staff are to do their job and should frame the way they do their job. If you're framing your job as watching human beings, that turns into watching animals, and that turns into hating animals. That's kind of what you see right now. The job that systems largely have is warehousing. That's what their money is for. That's what legislators give their budget and a focus on. I know many great people in systems, especially in the DOC in Wisconsin, that want to see things go different. They want people to be prepared. But the way the money is and the way that their charter is built is to warehouse. And so when you have that as the mission, when you have that as the purpose of the funding, when you have that as the culture, you're going to have the treatment and the opportunities reflecting that, which is going to be just have beds, just have places to put people, just respond to fires and and keep it so the bad news is as quiet as possible and that we're not getting a lot of negative attention on us and on the leadership in the government and all that type of stuff. So if you shift that, two things, one, the culture, and also the way you partner with entities that can come in and help, you're going to start seeing that change. So that looks like, one, having staff view their role as not just watching human beings, but in a social worker capacity, right? Like, your job is the growth of human beings. Your job is the stability of these individuals coming back to society. Your job is public safety from a standpoint of human beings being stable to be safe for society. That shifts the way you see your interactions with people inside. Two, if you're partnering with entities that are doing good out in the community, they can come in and also provide that same level of support and guidance and resources and education right away, well before a person comes home. So many organizations want to get inside. So many organizations are inside. How are we having a standard and having a partner SOP, so to speak, for the DOC and for jails that allows us or requires us to make sure that partners are getting in to meet the need and that partners are knowing that they have a standard they have to meet in doing that? That's more than just, we're just doing something. It can't just be that. It has to be you're doing something at a really high level, the same way that universities and colleges are doing out in the world. So those are the two things, and that's the way that looks.
We just heard about that cell-to-table event. Why did you decide to focus on food as part of this this education mission to humanize people in the incarceration system?
When you break bread with people, you get to see a different side of them. You're open to a different side of them. You're open to their mistakes in a way that softens your reaction, but you're also open to letting them see you, right? And so that element of it was what we thought could be a doorway to have the public and have even people who are in this work access a different part of this issue that maybe they weren't aware of, or access the issue for the first time ever. And so when you sit down, you get food and you get a story told through the food as well, right? The food is part of the experience. It's not just good food that you can have while you hear this. It's food made based off of the types of things that we eat inside a prison, which is based off of scarcity. It's based off of limited items and the creativity that people make with those limited items. It's based off of taking things from chow hall and from the kitchen to have something more comforting. It's a whole universe of story and of experience and impact and just relevance and powerful parts that come together to tell that story through food that people in prison knew. So how can we turn that into a real world version of these items, right? How do we make the hookups that people are so commonly aware of in prison, how do we make that something that people in the world can eat and get that story of their resilience through the making of the food?
Shannon, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Shannon Ross, CEO and founder of the nonprofit organization, The Community. Earlier, we heard about an event that the group organized where formerly incarcerated chefs show off dishes inspired by those they created while in prison. The Community has a few upcoming events in Wisconsin that includes their five-year anniversary celebration that's in Milwaukee on November 6th. For everyone in the Green Bay area, Kate Archer-Kent will be there this Saturday for a coffee, meetup, and chat. It's at the Kavarna Coffee House from 9 to 10:30 in the morning. Kate would love to hear about life in Northeast Wisconsin and your connections to the community. Plus, you could share local recommendations, maybe some story ideas, too. It's free to attend, but there's limited space. So RSVP at WPR.org/presents. That's WPR.org/presents. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Lauren Cox, and Mackenzie Crummy. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.